Let's get started on Perek Lamed Daled Lamed He. This is brand new. We are now done with the Hoyes. The following two chapters actually read fairly easily. Did people get a chance to look at them in advance?
Yes.
Some yeses. This is the run-up to the Assyrian invasion. Recognize what's coming next. Here come the Assyrians, is what we're seeing in the next two chapters, 34, 35. 36 and 37 begin for us the adventures of King Chizkiyahu. We've anticipated him for so long. Yeshaya has been predicting him for ages. He will finally be here. 36 and 37 will be the Assyrian invasion. 38 will be Chizkiyahu's illness and recovery. And then 39 is Chizkiyahu and the Babylonians. One note which will be relevant when we get to 36-37, Abarbanel asks, and you have to ask it, is this doesn't belong here. Meaning, this story is going to appear almost verbatim of the Assyrian invasion, is going to appear almost in verbatim in Malachim. Why are we bothering? Why is this here in Yeshaya at all? So much so that some of the commentators on Yeshaya say, look what I wrote over in Malachim. I think Radak does that. I think even Ezra does that. Other than a couple of words that they choose, that's it. That's all they have to say is, go see what I wrote over there. So Barbanel's answer is, because this isn't here for the history. It's here for the Yeshaya part. And there's more to be said about that, and we'll talk about that when we get to 36, 37. But what we're going to see right now is the run-up to that story, and it's a very simple structure. I brought it for you on the sheet. Structure of chapters 34, 35, right? Assault on the nations, meaning God's attack on the nations, is foretold. The utter ruin that the nations come into, and then the flowering of Israel's desert and the restoring of those who have suffered. It's really nice, at least if you're not one of the nations. I gave you the preparation questions there on the sheet. I'm not going to go over them now. They were meant for preparation. But the overall theme in this section is Hashem is going to devastate the nations. And if you look at chapter 34, sentence 8, we're on page 1011 now. You see why? After describing the assault on the nations, or at the end of the assault on the nations, he says, Kiyom Nakam Lashem, it is day of vengeance for God. Shnas Shilumim Leriv Tzion. It is a day of Shilumim, like Tashlumin, of payback. A fight on behalf of Tzion. In other words, the nations have sinned against God, and therefore it is Yom Nakam Lashem. And the nations have sinned against Tzion, and therefore it is also a day of Tashlumin, of payback for Riv Tzion. That's what we are seeing described here. This happens, it seems. Well, let me ask you, when does it sound like this happened? Those who had a chance to see the Perek, to see Lamed Daled especially in this regard, when is this happening?
Well, the talking about Edom, it has to be far into the future.
Right.
Or
so
maybe the
future. Right. So the fact that you invoke Edom, it sounds like it should be far into the future, and I think that's the way you have to really take it, and not only for that reason. A lot of the language is very eschatological. It's very Mashiach-oriented. Go back to Psukim Gimel and Dalet, sentences 3 and 4. Look at this description here. I'm going to work from the Hebrew, and you can follow along in the English if you want. It talks about the corpses of the enemy. This is very graphic, this section, much more than you usually see. Their corpses are strewn about. The smell rises from them. The mountains themselves are filled with blood from them. It seems to be describing something we have not seen before, certainly in a fight on behalf of Yehuda. V'namaku kol tzva shamayim. But then is really where it shifts gears. All the hosts of heaven are going to melt away. V'nagolu kasefer hashamayim. This is a phrase we have to come back and translate, but I'll take it right now the way they do. The heavens will be rolled up like a scroll. Well, we're going to get to Uvavahu shortly. We're not there yet. But it sounds like the heavens are done for. All of their forces will wither like a leaf from a grapevine, from the fig that shrivels up. And then jump to Pasuk Chet, sentence 8, we just read, the day of vengeance for God. But keep on reading after that, right? You see how the streams of water all turn to pitch, the dirt turns to gofri, to sulfur. The land is in ruins. Day and night, it will not be extinguished. The smoke will rise perpetually. From generation to generation, it will be in ruins. No one will pass there. Like, this is total apocalypse, what you're seeing here. And it runs into Perek Lamed Hey. Take a look, please, in chapter 35, on the next page, Psukim Hey and Vav, sentences 5 and 6. This is the flip side. This is the happy side of the apocalypse. Az tipakachna einei ivrim, the blind will have their eyes opened. The deaf will be able to hear. The one who had been lame is going to skip like an ayal. The one who had been mute, his tongue is going to sing. Right? So it's the healing of all those who had been harmed. This isn't associated with a normal war. This isn't routine. This is something that's apocalyptic, something that is messianic. And Ibn Ezra says so. I brought it on your sheet. If you take a look at source number 4, although he notes an opposing view, he says, Kol Mefarshim Orin Kizela Atid, all the commentators say this is about the future. Only, he mentioned, Rabbi Moshe HaKohen says that it's actually the downfall of Edom. Janine said, well, wait a minute, if it's Edom, that if it's Edom, it's got to be in the future. He says, no, Edom was also destroyed in the time of Assyria. And therefore, this actually fits with the Assyrian invasion that's coming next, and it's all one contiguous section. But nobody else thinks that that's serious. Everybody else says
Edom
this is...
Edom was mentioned earlier, wasn't it?
Yes. And we're going to come back to that reference. We're not quite there yet, but yes, you are correct. The Rashi talks about the fall of the angels of Assyria and Babel here. Like, this is a future messianic time. However, even though I am telling you that I, along with basically everybody except for Moshe HaKohen, thinks this is predicting something that is in the time of Mashiach, I still think it's setting the stage for the Assyrian invasion. Not because it's a prediction of what's going to happen in the Assyrian invasion. It's definitely a warning to all of our enemies at all times. And Barbanel makes this point. I brought it for you. Take a look quickly at number 5 on the sheet, where he highlights it. He says, I'm reading my English translation. The introduction and prologue of this portion demonstrate its importance and the power of the future mentioned in it. It begins, draw near nations to hear. Nations, listen up. Kirvu goyim l'shmoa. It's a summons to all of them. It's not addressed to the house of Israel. It's not for Judea. It's not for Yerushalayim. It's for all of the nations who had besieged us in exile. It called them to hear the heavenly decree. So it really is for everybody. And that's not something I would disagree with. But I'm thinking about Yeshaya's audience. And the audience, not an audience years later, but the life audience, the people who Yeshaya is talking to, if this is delivered during the time of King Chizkiyahu, like the rest of the Nevuot that are around it. And the way I would read this is Hashem is saying to them, Assyria is coming, but no matter what happens, I'm there to save you and redemption is coming. And this is my description to you of what you can ultimately anticipate, even if it's an apocalyptic thing that isn't going to happen yet. Yeah, you could also add to that the possibility which we've discussed all book long, which is that Chizkiyahu could have been Mashiach, in which case all of this could have happened then. It didn't have to be something that would be for the future. But that's the what I see here is that this is particularly important for the Jews who are anticipating the Assyrian arrival. Clear? I'll show you what this means. Take a look in Malachim Bet. Chapter 18. Kings 2, chapter 18. You're on page 927. Chapter 18, sentence 9. This is the Assyrian invasion of Yisrael, of the northern kingdom, and it happens in Chizkiyahu's fourth year. Okay? Fourth year on the throne. It was in the fourth year, just reading straight. It was in the fourth year of King Chizkiyahu, the seventh year of Hoshea ben Elah, who was the king in the north. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, invaded Samaria, besieged it. They captured it after 3 years. In the sixth year of Chizkiyahu, ninth year of Hoshea, Shomron was captured. The king of Assyria exiled Yisrael to Assyria, placing them in Halach, Chabor, by the Gozan River, the cities of Media. This is because they didn't heed the voice of Hashem. Write this your little summary of the Assyrian invasion of the northern kingdom. That's year 4 to year 6 of Chizkiyahu. Then it jumps to the 14th year of King Chizkiyahu, and Assyria invades Yehuda. And as we're going to see when we get to Perek Lamed Vav, Assyria's invasion seems to be a response to what we read about in Perek Chaf Bet of Yeshaya, which was Yehuda acted as though they were preparing to rebel against the Assyrians. The Assyrians thought when they exiled the northern kingdom that the southern kingdom was not going to be any trouble. Chizkiyahu starts to prepare defenses for an apparent revolt against the Assyrians, and the Assyrians invade. Of Chizkiyahu.
Yeah, the Assyrians go, they get rid of the
northern.
Northerns, and they...
8 years later, they're back.
8 years later, they're back.
Correct. Precisely.
Okay. And Yeshayahu is now, saying that, don't worry, everything's going to be fine.
Everything's going
to
be fine.
To the audience that is now going to be invaded by the Assyrians.
You got it.
And Abarbanel, I'm very confused about it.
Abarbanel is trying to say that this is a message with broader implications. It's a message for the world.
He's living during the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, he is.
And he's saying that.
Yes, he is.
Okay. Also giving people
hope. Yes, and that's actually something that we're going to come back to. Because that's going to fit into his comments here, actually. But take a look at 927 at Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13. In the 14th year of King Chizkiyahu, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Yehuda and captured them. Only Yerushalayim makes it out. I mean, some others presumably as well, but Yerushalayim is the one we know about. Chizkiyahu, king of Yehuda, sends word to the king of Assyria, to Lachish, saying, I have sinned. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose upon me, I will bear. He apologizes to the Assyrians. He apologizes to Sennacherib. And the king of Assyria imposes a fine, 300 talents of silver, 30 talents of gold. Chizkiyahu gives all the money he has, sends everything away to the Assyrians, and it doesn't matter. The Assyrians invade anyway. The Assyrians attack Yerushalayim regardless. But what Hashem is saying here is, don't worry, I'm going to crush the nations. I'm actually not sure whether I ended up bringing the piece from Abarbanel that I was thinking about, Bria, in response to your point, so I'll say it outside of the text. What Abarbanel notes, and I can't remember exactly where he says it, but it's somewhere in here, is the obligation for the leadership to bolster the spirits of the people. And he very much sees himself doing it, and it's going to come up. I don't know if we're going to get to it today,
but it's
going to come. Yeah, but specifically when we get to number 10, you'll see what I mean. He has a very specific piece that supports this. Again, maybe we'll get there today, maybe we won't. But that's the idea here, is that the nation is panicked. They are absolutely frightened, despondent. What are we going to do? And what you see here in Yeshaya's response is different from earlier predictions of divine judgment for the nations that we've seen in this book. Meaning, we saw chapters 13 to 23, right, where he went all around all the different enemies, including Edom, and talked about what's going to happen to them collectively, but there was one by one. Here, it's collective, even though he's going to refer to Edom specifically, he also is talking to, as Abarbanel said, all of the nations. That's number one. That's one difference, that this is everybody. Number two is that he's, as I said before, very graphic here. It's a very complete and very bloody devastation. And it's coupled with a message of resurgence and a message of healing for Yehuda. So I just told you that this is about collective, it's for everybody, and yet Edom is highlighted, right? So why is Edom highlighted? So it's clear that it's on everybody, first of all. Go back to the beginning of chapter 34. So we leave Malachim Bet. And we go back to Yeshaya chapter 34, page 1011. The opening sentences of the chapter. He says, Kirvu Goyim. He calls the nations, right? Not just one. He calls the Le'umim. I'm going to translate them as nations also. You know, if you want to be Malbim and find differences, you can. But he continues in Pasuk Bet, lest you think he's just calling the nations to witness what happens to Edom. It's not so. On page 1011. He says, Ki kesef Lashem al kol ha-goyim. Hashem's anger is on all of the nations. Chema al kol tziva'am. Against all of their forces. And in Pasuk Dalet, kol tziva ha-shamayim. All of the hosts of heaven. Everything is going to be leveled. And yet, if you go to sentence 5, Kirisav ha-shamayim charvi, right? My sword is quenched in the heavens. Hine al Edom tered, it will descend upon Edom. Ve'al am chermi lemishpat, the nation of my cherem, my destruction. So there's a very specific target. And it continues in the next sentence. Right? After all of the blood, the end of the sentence. Zebach Lashem bivotzra. There was a slaughter for God in Botzra. We have to talk about what Botzra is. The Tevach Gadol be'eretz Edom, a great slaughter in the land of Edom. So now we have a problem.
Possibly two places.
Well, possibly two places, depending on what Botzra is. But first you said everybody, and you were emphatic that it's everybody, and then you highlight Edom. So you could solve the problem by saying, this is
your Google in Lishma, so it doesn't mean he's to destroy him.
In the next sentence. How's that? Yeah, that's the that was my point. The first pasuk you can say is just the audience. Second pasuk doesn't work that way. That's the target. So you could solve the problem by saying this is a war against our enemies at the end, and Edom is the last great enemy standing. Edom is simply the last one left. Abarbanel has a very long discussion of this, of which, believe it or not, I only brought you a very short piece in number 7. We're going to look quickly at my translation of it. 6 was just the reference to where you could find the Assyrian invasion. For in the end, so is handy, you know, to know where the Assyrian invasion is. For in the end of days, Edom will be awakened to go conquer Jerusalem as their holy place. Notice that? What's he referring to here? I mean, it already happened by his day. All right, keep on reading. You'll see. Edom will be awakened to go conquer Jerusalem as their holy place. The Crusades. Exactly, the Crusades. And they will also conquer all of Egypt and their exiles. And the Assyrians and all the eastern lands will come battle them. Whether to avenge those killed by Edom from Egypt and other Arab nations in Israel, or because Jerusalem and the temple are also a place of great holiness and the entrance of heaven for Ishmaelites. Therefore, all of them will gather to take it from the Christians. He's describing the Crusades, but keep in mind, in Abarbanel's day, the wars between Islam and Christianity are still going. The expulsion of Jews from Spain is a gesture of thanks to God from the Spanish government, the Spanish monarchy, for the Reconquista, for the fact that they were able to take back Spain from the infidels. That's why they do it. This is still a going thing in Abarbanel's day. And in his mind, here's how it's going to play out. There will be a resurgence of the Christians towards Israel. The Muslims are going to fight them there. And this is what we call the War of Gog and Magog.
So Edom are the Christians.
You got it. Then will be a great catastrophe for Edom and for those who battle them. For since the Assyrians destroyed Israel, this is great, and the Romans, Edom, destroyed it a second time, there was a divine decree that in that land, Israel, where they came at other times to attack it wickedly, there they will receive their punishment and God's vengeance will be upon them. I skipped the word. And the land will not be atoned for the Jewish blood spilled in it, other than with the blood of the one who spilled it. Right? Which is, of course, a pasuk. in the place of wickedness, there is the judgment. That's also a pasuk. That's pulled out of Koheles. And therefore, the prophet mentioned here the general vengeance of the nations. And then it mentioned the destruction of Edom specifically, which will be within that vengeance. He says, this is for all the nations, but Edom is highlighted. So Alina says, oh, so Edom is Rome. Boy, did Abarbanel, you know, he's really happy you asked that question. The Abarbanel on this parak decides that he is going to give you a long excursus on this issue of the Edom-Rome association. We talked about this a while back when we saw Edom mentioned in that group of 10 enemies in 13 to 23. So I brought you various opinions on the relationship between Rome and Edom. Was it because Edom supported the Romans originally, the Idumeans supported them in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? Was it because Edom adopted Christianity and Christianity came to be identified with Rome and therefore Edom is associated with Rome? Abarbanel goes to town on this because he writes that there was some Jew, and I don't know who he was talking about, but evidently he was famous back in the day, that there was some Jew who had converted to Christianity and chose to make a name for himself by debunking the Edom-Rome association and claiming that it's all a myth and all the predictions about Edom have nothing to do with Christianity. And Abarbanel goes on at length, quoting Jewish sources, quoting Christian sources, on and on and on, to prove Edom and Rome are similar. The only thing I wanted to bring you here, because I was not going to subject you to all that, but in number 8, I highlighted 5 points where he says, even if you don't have a territorial association, even if you don't have a genealogical association, you have a cultural association. You have an identity which you see in Rome that matches what the Torah tells us about Edom. And that's what he chooses to talk about here. I just picked out his 5 comparisons and summed them up for you in number 8. He says, we have the same father in our religions, meaning the Christianity and Judaism claim to trace back to the same source. Esav and of course, sorry, connect all the dots. Rome, Edom connects to Esav, who has the father, which is ours. Esav and Edom serve their father/father with trickery, right? Meaning they claim to be serving God in the same way that Esav claims to be serving Yitzhak. Esav married among the nations, his wives angered God. Ditto for the nations which have merged with Rome. Right? Esav's wives upset Yitzhak and Rivka because they bring in their idolatry. So too, the nations which have merged with Rome have taken pagan elements and imported them into Christianity. Esav received material blessings while Yaakov received spiritual blessings, and Edom, Rome, has received material blessings, and Esav hates Yaakov and wishes to kill him, and the rest is self-explanatory. So that he sees this as proving the Edom Rome association. Yes?
I didn't realize I signaled that I was kidding. It's just so interesting because in Abarbanel's time, the church was the persecutor.
Yeah.
We live in such different times.
Yes, absolutely. Rebecca points out, this is culturally dependent. He lives in an age when the great enemy is the church.
Right.
And not just in an era when it is, but in a country where it is.
Right.
Ask the Jews who are living in Morocco how they felt.
Right. Exactly.
You know, it really does vary based on where you are, but Abarbanel is very much a darshan. He is speaking to his audience and trying to buck up their spirits, and you'll see it very strongly
shortly.
I think. But I don't want to rush it. You'll see. But he has this great... I mean, it's such a long piece here on this. But also keep in mind, the idea that Edom's downfall should come at the end of days has an added resonance. Am Chermi, right? We read. He called them Am Chermi, the nation of my destruction. If you, not knowing our perek, just knowing Chumash, had to say who Am Chermi should be to God, who would it be?
Amalek.
Right? Who is the grandson of? Esav. right? Amalek is the son of Eliphaz, who is the son of Esav. So that fits in with this as well. And Rashi actually says it explicitly. I didn't bring it on here. But Rashi on Amchermi, unlike Radak and Abarbanel, who say Amchermi is Edom, Rashi says it's Amalek. Which would make sense, because the war with Amalek is Midor Dor, right? Generation to generation until the end. There's only one problem. There's one substantive problem here, which is what do you do with Botsra? Who brought Botsra into this? The same problem shows up if you jump ahead in Yeshaya to chapter 63, sentence 1. The part of the book we hope to get to this year. Take a look at page 1061. You see that? Comes from the Haftarah. Chapter 63, Samach Yimam. Mizeh ba mi'edom, me'edom, right? Chamutz bigadim mi'botzra. Right? This is a reference to God destroying Edom. But it says, who is it who comes from Edom with his garments chamutz, like vinegar, right? From Botsra. Botsra sounds like a place. You could read it as a grape harvest if you want over there. It fits. But what is this? So Rashi quotes you from the Medrash that Botsra is in Moab. Because we have, when you identify the cities of refuge on the eastern side of the Yarden, the Arei Miklat, one of them is Betzer. And Betzer is in Moab. The problem is, what would they be doing here? So Rashi tells you that we know in Bereshit Lamed Vav, we get the list of the kings of Edom. So one of them was Yovav ben Zerach mi Botsra. One of the kings was a king from Botsra. So he suggests that's why Moab is struck here as well, because they provided a king for Edom. That's one solution. But Ibn Ezra says something different. Ibn Ezra says in source number 9, actually I brought you here just because it was fun. I brought you his first comment. Yesh omer shehu Konstantina. He says, some say Botsra is Constantinople. That can't be. Because it's not as though it's been around for 1,000 years, such that Yeshaya would have spoken about it. To which I would answer, yes, but we are going to see. We've already talked about the fact that Yeshaya prophesizes about things that haven't existed in his day. So he could well be talking about a Botsra that doesn't exist yet, just like he talks about a Cyrus that doesn't exist yet. If you have a problem with this one, I have a different part of the book to show you. Nonetheless, his conclusion is, it's Medina Be'eretz Edom. It's something in Edom. And the commentators say it. Abarbanel says as well. He says, why couldn't another city be called Botsra? So there's one in Moab and there's one in Edom. But look what he does in number 10. I'm glad we made it to this week. This is your reward for putting up with all the other difficult things. Take a look at what Abarbanel does. Radak, by the way, says it's in Edom. But Abarbanel's the best. He says, granted that we have seen another Botsra in Moab, named this because it is a reinforced city, right? Not Libtzor like a grape harvest, but Bitzira is reinforcement. It's a reinforced city. But he says, why couldn't Rome also be called that? Since it's like that, it's also reinforced. And who knows if the prophets intended to call Rome Botsra because the gematria of Betzer is 692. And then the five, the hay, is 5,000, hinting to the year 5692, when the destruction of Rome will be complete. The year, in case you're wondering, is 1532. For I have told you in Mayanea Yeshua and Yeshuot Mishicho, commentaries to Yeshaya and to Daniel, respectively, what they, Zichronam Livracha, mentioned from the scroll found in the Roman archives, I don't know what those are, saying it would be destroyed in 5691 from creation, since this is their tradition. They called it Botsra, which is that number. Botsra is Edom, because in 1532, they are going to fall. They remember, Abarbanel, and this is what I meant when I was talking about him speaking to his audience and giving them strength. I think Alina was here. Louise, I don't think you were here when we did Daniel, were you?
Yeah, I think I might have.
You might have been. So, Rebecca was. When we did, you were here. So you may recall that at one point in Daniel, you get a prediction about a certain number of sevens and sevens of sevens and so on for redemption. And Abarbanel tries to make the calculation. We were actually in that room. We were in the Weinbaum Beis Medrash at the time. He says if you do the math, starting from, he starts his count from the split of Yehuda and Yisrael in order to get to it. But he says, Mashiach is going to come in the year 1502. That's his prediction. And then he realizes, no, there's a half year that I counted wrong because it's for mid-year, 1503. And then he pushes it, I think he ends up pushing it to 1504, 1505 before he says, you know what, maybe I shouldn't be giving years. But apparently not, because he came up 1532 here. I don't remember, but it's in between those 1500s and this. He doesn't live to 1532. I don't remember what year he passed.
He doesn't see that he was wrong.
No. It's not him who's wrong. It's a document of the Roman archives. But yes. But that's the idea. So the theme here is the fall of the collective enemies. And we're talking to, Yeshaya is talking to the Jews of his day, the time of Chizkiyahu, saying, you've been anticipating this invasion for a long time. You've been frightened of what was coming. Don't worry. The enemies will fall. And in particular, Edom, who again, they don't know, the Edom-Rome Association, they never knew anything about Rome. They haven't even met a Babylonian yet. They, nonetheless, that's the association that he's trying to give them of this ultimate downfall. Okay. This ultimate downfall of the collective foes of the Jewish people. I want to take a few minutes just to pick on some specific elements and images here. Go back to 34:4, please. This business with the Namaku called Siva HaShamayim. All the hosts of heavens melting away. Dissolve, I see they do in the art scroll. Who is that? Who are the heavenly hosts who are falling away? I didn't translate the sources on this. I didn't think we were getting this far. But who are the heavenly hosts who are falling away? What does that mean? Who are dissolving, who are melting? So that's definitely an approach. Radak says, a rational approach. He says, these are the celestial bodies. I brought it for you in number 11. Right? He says, Lemisha tavolo tzara gedola, when someone experiences great trouble, it's ki'ilu nevchu ha-shamayim v'haratz alav. It's as though the heavens and the earth have turned on him. V'ray ha'olam lo ne'apach, the world is upside down for him. Ki'ilu ein tzva ha-shamayim, it's as though all of the celestial bodies don't exist. Ein lo ora, he has no light. Ha'olam choshech alav, the world goes dark for him. There's no illumination. Like what we saw in one of our predictions, chafra ha'levana u'boshach, right? We said the sun and the moon would go dark. So that's Radak. He says there's no more illumination from the celestial bodies. Abarbanel offers you a rational explanation as well, suggesting that God is going to override the dictates of astrology. Remember that in their day, astrology is science. Right? Just as for us, gravity includes the pull of various foreign bodies from a distance based on the mass, so too to them, there are forces that various heavenly bodies are able to exert. Whether they're conscious or not conscious almost doesn't matter. And what it's saying here is that all this Siva HaShamayim, all the forces in the heavens, will no longer be able to influence, such that in number 12, Avalpi, even though the instructions from on high indicate that those nations should succeed, Hashem is going to destroy their influence and override the dictates of astrology. So two approaches that don't resort to angels. And then, the other approach is absolutely, this is talking about the malachim of the nations. If you jump in your Tanakh, please, to Daniel, chapter 10, sentence 13, you get perhaps the most explicit reference in Tanakh to such angels. It is, where are we? Chapter 10. It is page 1805, chapter 10, sentence 13. Sar Malchus Paras Omeid Lenegdi. He describes seeing the angel who represents the Persians standing opposite me for 21 days, and then Michael, one of the first Sarim, one of the first angels, comes to help me, right? Daniel describes Malachim, angels that represent the various nations. It's not only that pasuk in Daniel either, but that happens to be a really good source for it. We saw it actually earlier, back in chapter 33, when we talked about Er Elam, chapter 33, sentence 7. So Radak there said that was the malachim of the different nations. The best example he saw in Yeshaya so far was actually in Perek Chaf Dalet, chapter 24, when he said that the day was coming, Lifkod al Tzvam Marom. Right? When God is going to call to account the Tzvam Marom, which you could take to mean sun, moon, and stars, but as in Netana Tokef, it's often taken as a judgment of the Malachim, a judgment of these angels who represent each nation. And according to that, what's going to happen back with us now, back on page 1011, in chapter 34, sentence 4, is that all the Malachim representing the nations are going to melt away. Abarbanel merges this with the astrology idea, and that the Malachim are tied to those astrological forces. But that's the idea. Such that, Malbim says, I keep turning around because I restarted the recorder for this parak, and now I don't know where I am in terms of timing. But but Malbim does something interesting with this. He talks about the image of the heavens being rolled closed like a book. He says, if you look at number 13, Ha'amim ha'kadmonim hayalahem ha'shamayim kesefer. The early nations, for them, the heavens were like a scroll. Bo ayu mabitim b'chochmas ha'itztagninus, asher hayalahem ba'isayi. They used astrology and looked at the stars, and kol ha'azid lavo aleihem. They were able to tell everything that was going to come to them in the future. They would read the future based on that, horoscopes. They associated each nation with a particular star. Such that with this book, with the heavens, they would read everything that was going to happen. But now, Ata, ki asur tzilam, when their shade, their protection leaves them, yigalel ha-sefer hazeh, the scroll is now rolled closed. Those who read it could not open it and read it anymore. Those forces are no longer able to be exerted on on the world. So you can't predict the future anymore from the astrology. One other note. In chapter 34, sentence 14, he describes the ruin that's going to come to these nations. And he describes as part of this, he says, "Upakshut siyim et iyim," which they call here, "Martins will encounter cats." Okay. "Visa'ir al re'ehu yikra," one sa'ir will call to the next, "Ach sham hirgi'a lilit," and there also the lilit will be ragua, will relax. So the nations become a place for the Seir and the Lilith. So, of course, when you look at that, those are terms that are often associated with demons, right? The Seir, Seirim Yerkedusham, Lo Yizbechu Adzivchayim La Seirim. It's a reference to a demon, and Lilith is understood as well as referring to a female demon. I'm not going into the whole idea of Chava and Adam's first wife. But just on a very basic level, it's often taken that way, such that what it's saying is, those nations will now, well, their land will now be associated with demons. However, Ibn Ezra and Radak say no. They say Sa'ir is a goat that lives in the desert, and Lilith is a kind of bird, which fits, because the rest of the psukim after the Lilith here, Shama, Kinenu, Kipoz, and onward from there, are bird references. So they don't like the idea that this is demonology. So what we've seen today, what we hopefully got out of 34, 35, I'm leaving aside the discussion about the end of 33, but hopefully what we got here is a prediction of, yes, the Assyrians are coming, however, God is ultimately, whether it's going to be through Chizkiyahu as Mashiach or in the distant future, Hashem is going to call everyone to account of the bloody assault on the nations and their utter ruin. And then in 35, Israel's desert is going to flower. This is very eschatological in its imagery, both in the destruction and in the healing at the end. What I want to do next time, just to wrap this, is number one, he talks about reading the book of God and seeing if anything is missing. So I want to come back to that. That's in 34:16. He has a prediction that the dangerous animals will disappear from Israel in 35:9, and I want to talk about that because that's an image we saw much earlier in Yeshaya. And then there are just a few quick pieces of language that I thought are worth seeing in here, including Ora, the Tohu Vavohu reference. I want to mention that, although I can't explain it. So we'll come and see that, and then we move into the actual Assyrian invasion in Prakim Lamed Vav and Lamed Zayin. Thank you very much.